Joined by a special guest now, Tony Romanucci. And every time I say a good Italian name, Tony, I've got to like put my fingers up like that. It helps me with the pronunciation to say it. Tony, welcome to the program here today.
Well, luckily we're on the radio and they can't see all of our hand gestures, right?
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, joking around here in the intro, but a serious discussion I want to have. And it's a fascinating legal debate with a horrific backdrop. Obviously, everyone remembers the Parkland shooting. It's fresh in our minds about a year and a half ago. It was last February, I believe, right. 17. Children taken way too soon. We had David Hogan here a couple months ago and chatted with him. He's the student that's really risen to prominence in terms of his reaction to it and kind of trying to motivate young voters in this country. I digress, though. The security guard who was on duty, the school security officer, is being charged with child negligence, other charges along that lines. And, you know, this would be a max situation. I don't think we're going to see this. But if he's found guilty, could serve up to nearly 100 years in prison. I'm sure it wouldn't be that. They'd work out the sentencing. It struck me immediately, Tony, as kind of cruel. But your experience in this work, first of all, maybe introduce yourself, your firm, and how you have some experience in this sort of field.
So I'm an attorney with the firm of Romanucci and Blandon, and we concentrate our types of cases on very similar cases to what happened in Parkland. We help people who have been aggrieved by acts of torts, by negligence. And so we're involved in a case that many listeners might be aware of, the Pulse Orlando shooting, mm-hmm. that disaster, that catastrophe, horrific shooting where, you know, 50-some people were killed by that individual. So I'm aware of some of the issues that we have here. So I think part of the analysis that we have to have is, what was Officer Peterson supposed to be doing that day? Well, we know that he was a sworn police officer. We know that he was trained to possess a gun. So assumedly he was trained on that gun, went to the range, knew how to shoot it. Third, his job was a little bit more specific than being a patrol officer on the street. He was assigned to a school.
Specific zone, know where
Correct.
You're supposed to be, yeah.
It's not like he's traveling off campus looking at, you know, looking to stop an armed robbery or burglary or even issue a traffic citation.
Right.
No, he had a specific job. He was trained. He was told to do specific work. And what do we know about what he did based on the video surveillance mm-hmm. and what other witnesses said? He didn't do his job. He was trained to be there to stop active shooters. He did not do that. We know that protocol has changed now since the beginning of time, mm-hmm. which is Columbine,
right.
of how active shooters are supposed to be engaged. You don't do what he said you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to stop and scan and assess,
set
and
up a perimeter,
pull back,
or anything
set
like
up
that.
A perimeter.
Yeah,
no that's
in.
Not what you're supposed. You're supposed to go in, and God forbid, you're supposed to be a distraction for that shooter to take away from the multiple lives, and you're supposed to. You are supposed to sacrifice your life for others. That's your sworn job as a police officer.
Is there much precedence in these sorts of cases of someone not meeting their, you know, what they were sworn to do, whether it's a school shooting or something similar in nature?
So let me answer it this way. In this criminal setting, I'm not aware of any. In a civil setting, it's been done before. People have filed lawsuits against police officers for failing to do their job. But I have to tell you, it's extremely difficult from a civil standpoint. There are immunities. I mean, like if we were to bring this lawsuit in Illinois,
mm-hmm.
if I were to sue a police officer for failing to do his job, I'd probably not succeed.
Yeah.
Right now, the way the laws are, we would fail.
Now, if it's that hard in civil court, with the burden of proof being even higher in a criminal court, these are really difficult cases to prove because you've got to get in his mind at that moment, and he has claimed that he thought he was doing the right thing. That's hard to prove because do you have to prove malice in it, or do you just have to prove unintentional that he just didn't do the job straight up? I mean, what's the burden here that they have to surpass?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, the burden that, you know, this prosecutor has right now is beyond a reasonable doubt. So what does he have to show? He has to show that these charges of neglect, of contributing to the harm of a child, that is so far above the standard that we're familiar with in a civil case, preponderance, which is it more probably
more than
true
half,
than
yeah,
not?
Right.
Yeah. So now, beyond a reasonable doubt, if Peterson's defense sets it up that, hey, I was protecting those kids. I thought that I was doing what I was trained to do. I, you know, pulled out my gun. I didn't see the shooter. If that defense sets up on that way, a reasonable, unbiased jury.
Right.
Okay, I said unbiased.
Right, which is hard to do in Florida right now, especially on this case or any case.
Really. I wouldn't want to be on trial on this case in Florida right now. An unbiased jury would have to say, you know, state, you have not met your burden.
And you don't even you need one person to say that and to really hold their ground.
You need all 12.
Oh, what I'm saying is you need one person to take his side on
this. Oh, right,
sort of
you only need one person to hang that jury, yeah. Sure.
My other question is I imagine, and look, I totally get it. He had a bulletproof vest. He has a weapon. That's what he's sworn to do. And I'd love to think that me in that situation, now I'd never put myself in that situation swearing that oath to do that. And by him taking that oath, it puts him in a different circumstance. But is there any sympathy to be had? And I'm not asking you necessarily as a lawyer, but as a juror, I imagine that could be something the defense is going to go after too. Just imagine being in this harrowing situation. Something on the book, following the letter of the law or what you're supposed to do, is easier said than done when you hear bullets, when you fear for your own life. Certainly a jury, at least one juror, can be swayed by that argument.
Oh, absolutely. If you want to take the bird's eye view of this whole scenario, Peterson can, he will be painted as a very sympathetic, actually savior type person.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you know, these parents, these children, this community wants justice. And the prosecutor is delivering to them a measure of justice. I don't know that they'll be successful, but maybe this community will heal somewhat from this. But the other thing that you don't want is also what lawyers are very fearful of, and anybody should be, and that's bad precedent.
Yeah. I gotta wonder too, the president, President Trump tweeted about this situation, about this guard, went as far as almost to calling him a coward, and then he kind of backed it. So I don't know necessarily about a coward, but did cowardly things in this moment. When you have the President of the United States weighing in, that certainly changes the dynamics of the case.
Oh, of course it does. It changes the dynamics incredibly, because when you look at, you know, the demographics of Florida, you know, we don't mm-hmm. need to go back to the year 2000, right? We don't
Let's
need to
not.
Do that.
Yeah.
But when you look at Florida demographics, Trump, depending on where you're located, is going to persuade people very heavily.
Oh, for sure.
So I don't know how this man is going to get a fair trial. And even though I'm on the side of representing victims, I want Peterson to get a fair trial mm-hmm. because I want everyone to get a fair trial. That's what we should all strive for. And what Trump did is unnecessarily insert himself in a situation where he has now created an unfair circumstance for Peterson.
He's done that in other cases as well, too. Probably should put the phone away just in a few different circumstances, just to say the least, but we'll move on from that. You're working on the case not only with the Pulse Nightclub, but with Las Vegas. These are challenging cases for you. Why? What drives you to take these cases on if they are so difficult?
Well, really, I mean, you know, when you take a case on like this, you're not doing it for anything but for the policy. I mean, there comes a certain point where I've reached a point in my practice and my age where you really want to be able to say that you've done something good, not just for only one person, but for an entire community. And by taking on these cases, that's the great hope. You know, Pulse Nightclub, you know, what can you say about that, you know, horrific tragedy, except that somebody was handed, literally, they were handed a gun license to purchase massive amounts of ammunition and guns, long guns, semi-automatics, to do one thing, kill.
The security firm you're referring to.
The security firm, which was G4S. You know, it's really, for me, as just a human being, not even a lawyer, it's just hard for me to understand why anyone would have access to one of these long guns,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to even 10 of them, 20 of them, or in the Las Vegas case, 33 of them. Why? There's only one purpose. Mass destruction, killing of people. We're not hunting with these weapons. We're only doing it for the killing of people. We're not using them for self-protection. We're totally going the opposite way of the Second Amendment. So that's why, you know, lawyers take these cases on and fight the way that they do, hoping for change.
In Las Vegas, you talk a little bit about the case that you're working on with them.
Well, in Las Vegas, that was the instance where, you know, the shooter in that case, with the help of the Mandalay Bay Hotel, was assisted up to his room carrying 33 guns and thousands of rounds of ammunition.
Now, they're going to say it was obviously in containers and they'd have no idea what was going on. What do you guys contend? That they should have known, should have checked more, should have checked baggage?
Well, I'm going to answer that question just a little bit circuitously.
Okay, please do. Yeah, I don't know if I'm going in areas I'm not supposed to go.
Oh, no, no.
Yeah.
You're going in areas
I'll
where
keep
you,
on
you,
going, yeah.
You should be asking these questions. But what needs to be known about what Mandalay Bay knew that we found out that they failed to disclose was that about 18 months before this particular shooting, there was another active shooter in that building.
Really?
Mandalay Bay was on notice that the Strip, as putting aside any personal bias, as Steve Wynn predicted 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that the Las Vegas Strip was probably the highest soft target on this nation's hit list.
So you would contend that these hotels were negligent in not having security measures in place to anticipate something like this, even if they didn't know specifically that that gentleman walked in with weapons?
100% correct. Because, and here's why, when Steve Wynn made that prediction, he actually did something about it. He just didn't talk about mm-hmm. it and say that we all need to be on notice. He actually implemented the platinum standard security measures in his hotels. You'd never see them. The gambler, the person who's dining, they would never see those mm-hmm. security measures that he has in place.
That'd be me. I'd be at the craps table having no idea what was happening elsewhere.
Heck no. You wouldn't see who's behind you watching you at all.
You could say that right for sure.
And those other hotels didn't take the same measures.
Yeah.
So somebody raised the bar. The others failed to take those measures. And you, what's the result is tragedy, mm-hmm. such as what happened on Route 91.
Tony, do you have any, obviously the case involving Scott Peterson isn't one that you're working on, which means that I can ask you this question. What is your anticipation of how this is going forward? Do you think we might have a plea between the two parties, reach a settlement, or do you think that this is something that this prosecutor wants to bring to a trial?
Well, I think the prosecutor knows. Look, the prosecutor has to know what a difficult challenge he has. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is he charged under a statute that's not even meant for police officers. It's meant for parents. It's meant for caregivers.
Right, because that was part of the argument of whether he really falls into this caregiver category.
He's not a caregiver. I don't know under what definition he could become a caregiver, but maybe I'm not the smartest guy, you know, here either.
You're in this room. Guy in this room. I'll tell you that much. Well, there's only two of us, so.
So if you were to ask for my wild prediction, I would see that there's going to be a carve out of a charge that is as close as possible to what this man may have committed, and there's going to be a plea. I don't know how this man's going to get a fair trial. I don't know if the community is going to tolerate a trial where he could be found not guilty. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say there's going to be a carve out of some non-jail time for him. It's going to be more than a slap on the wrist, and he will be the fall guy for it.
Tony Romanucci, founding partner at Romanucci and Blandon, and thanks for. Did you walk over? Or did you get in a cab? It's a nice day out. It's a little hot though.
I walked.
Yeah,
I'm going to take advantage of this. Are you kidding?
You're over on Clark Street, so you ain't too far away.
I walked. It's warm in Chicago.
Yeah, you better believe it, Tony. It's a difficult conversation, but thanks for breaking it down.
I appreciate it. Absolutely. Thank you for having me.